What I wanted to do today, rather than go through the all of the psukim in the parasha, is just to go through the outline very briefly, and then to look with you at a particular subject which doesn't get looked at much, which I think is actually very interesting, which is the question as to when can we and when can't we take psukim literally. Okay, which is, I think this is a really important question, especially anyone who's familiar with any other sort of systems of understanding, Bible or Tanakh or whatever, whether it's Christian or whether it's Bible, biblical Christianism, whatever it is. I think this is important to get something of a Jewish perspective, of an authentic Jewish perspective on this, and therefore that's what I want to look at with you, Be'ezrat Hashem, in a few moments. First of all, let me just look at the outline with you very quickly. If you look at the outline, please, that I gave you, the subject matter of the parasha goes like this. First of all, we have Avram and the three visitors, and that's actually what we're going to be looking at in the sheet that I've given you. Hashem informs Avraham of the destruction of Sodom. Okay, so after the three visitors come, of course, what are the three visitors there to do? To announce that he's going to have a baby, and Sarah's going to have a baby, and the whole story that, you know, he gives them food, and she's listening in the tent, and she laughs, and they say, why is she laughing? God says, why is she laughing? You're going to have a baby, etc., etc. It's interesting to say that many people say that Yitzchak is called Yitzchak because Sarah laughed when she heard she was going to have a baby. That's not true. Because Yitzchak is called Yitzchak because last week Abraham laughed when he was going to have a baby, and the two laughings are very different laughings. And if you look in the Mephoroshim, I recommend you to have a look there, see why Abraham's laugh and Sarah's laugh coming from a different place, they're translated differently in the Aramaic, etc. Anyway, of course, so they get the news, and the Malachim go away, and they go down to Sodom, and the whole episode with Lot, where he brings them in, and all the people of Sodom want to sleep with them, and to kill them, to abuse them, etc. And then the destruction of Lot, of Sodom, and Lot's rescue. That's actually a very interesting little bit just at the end there. If you look at where Sodom is being destroyed, how he escapes, where he escapes to, the wording he uses when he wants to escape, you also have the first of a number of, if you haven't got a chumash, you don't all need to get a chumash, but there is a note in the Torah, which is a shalshelet, which I've mentioned to you before, which looks a bit like this over the words. It only appears four times in the Torah, and it's a very unusual note when they sing it and when they're laying it. It's like, something like that. You can't miss it. It appears four times. Each time it appears, there is a connotation of hesitation. That somebody can't decide, this is going to be a big decision moment. Am I or am I not going to do this? The four times it comes are, one, when Lot is considering whether to run away, to stay, what's going to be. He's going to leave behind his whole life dream of money and riches and da-da-da-da, or he's going to run with his malachim. The second time it occurs, does anyone know? It's in next week's parsha, when Eliezer has been told that he has to find a wife for Yitzchak, and he's on the verge of kind of making a decision, who is this woman going to be? It's going to be, because he wanted his daughter to marry Yitzchak, you'll see the Midrashim there, but he's been told he has to choose someone else. So again, you have this word where he's hesitating. The third occasion on which this occurs is when Yosef is with Mrs. Potiphar, and he is making the life or death decision as to whether he is or is not going to give in to his Yetzer Hara to have a relationship with her. And the fourth time that this appears in Tanakh, or in the Torah, you're going to have to find out and tell me next time. And once you have found it out, then you're going to have... Yeah, this one is in... this one, so you can see the sign, is in the... let me just find it for a second. I haven't got the exact Possek reference here, but it will be very easy to find. Second. Okay. It's here. It's in Yud Tet, so you can't really see it here, can you? It's a Yud Tet, Tet Vav, 1916. You can think of something, the Battle of the Somme. Or something, 1916. It's Vayit Ma Ma, and it's Vayit Ma Ma. So, in this week's Parsha, 1916. Bereishis 1916. Okay? So, you look out for that, and then find me the fourth mention, the fourth reference to the Shalshelet in the Torah, and then you can work out why it's there. Given that you know it's a hesitation note, you can try and work out why it's there. Shalshelet. It's a chain. Okay? Now, then of course you have the interesting episode of Lot and his daughters, where Lot sleeps with his two daughters, sort of knowingly. He's drunk, but of course he knows what he's doing, and when he wakes up after the first one, he allows himself to get drunk and do it all again with the second one the next night, which tells you all about Lot, and we talked a little bit about that last time. And that's really Lot's exit from the entire Tanakh. We don't see Lot again, we only see him coming in through his descendants, who are Ammon, Moab, and later on, of course, Ruth, who is the great-grandmother of David HaMelech. So that's where we see Lot. One of the themes of Sefer Bereishis, you should know, overall themes, is different lines of the family being rejected. Okay? The family being, if you like, refined and refined and refined until you end up with what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants as Klal Yisrael. So you have Yishmael, so first of all, Lot goes off. Yishmael goes off. Esav goes off. And then there's the question mark as to whether that's going to continue. And we get into the whole parsha of the brothers and Yosef, and we'll see that the brothers understood that that's what had to happen to Yosef too. That Yosef was another bad egg. And just like we've been getting rid of the negatives out of Klal Yisrael, Esav, Yishmael, Lot, Yosef also has to go. And he has... The brothers understood that that's what they had to do with Yosef. And there was precedent for that. Because Uncle Esav was chucked out, and great Uncle Yishmael was chucked out, and Cousin Lot was also chucked out. So Yosef also is out. And of course that was the mistake. And we'll talk about that more when we get there. Anyway, so that's Lot. Then you have chapter 20, which is the kidnap of Sarah by Abimelech. This is similar, but not the same as the kidnap of Sarah by Paro. In last week's Parsha, you'll see that there are some similarities and some significant differences. Then you have chapter 21, which is a very beautiful chapter, which is the birth of Yitzchak and the celebration and the meal that Avram makes and all of all the singing and dancing and the happiness that comes when Sarah is able to have a baby. This is immediately followed by the expulsion of Hagar and Ishmael, which again is similar but not the same as the expulsion of Hagar in last week's Parsha. This time, of course, she's with her son. And again, whenever you get two Parshas which are very similar, you have to look carefully for the differences. And the differences can teach a great deal. So that's Hagar and Ishmael in this week's Parsha. And then Ishmael is basically out. That's the end of his role in the Psukim. A little bit of a comeback next week, or rather the week after. Next week, when they bury Avram Avinu. But other than that, he's out. Then there's this very interesting covenant with Abimelech. This is a bit of the parsha that's a bit of a dusty corner. People don't realize this. Avram decides to make a peace deal with the local Philistines, okay? Because he feels that his position in Eretz Israel is tenuous and will be strengthened by a peace deal with the local people. Chazal go to town on how this was a disastrous move and cause great deal of anguish and stress going through the future of the Jewish people, this peace deal which didn't end up to bring any kind of peace at all. And you can actually, there's a great deal of contemporary resonance on some level as to, this deals with the issue as to how do the Jewish people deal with the indigenous people of this country. How do we do deals with them? Do we try and be friendly but distant with them? Do we fight them? And you can read those psukim from 22 to 34. I recommend it. And you can see, you know, how Abimelech reacts once he's made a peace treaty. Does it help? Does it not help? I'll leave you to look at that. And then, of course, chapter 22 is the most famous one of all, which is the Akedah, which I'm not going to go into in detail, although it's perhaps, you know, the most important part of the Parsha. What's that? You did it in Elul. So a lot of people have done a lot on the Akedah, therefore I didn't want to do that again. But again, the Akedah, one little thing I might just mention to you may or may not have noticed, God tells Avram to take Yitzchak up as a korban and bring him up as the Akedah, to kill him in the Akedah. Does God ever reverse that announcement and tell Avram not to bring Yitzchak up as a korban? So Avram does bring Yitzchak up, or doesn't he?
Avram does bring Yitzchak up.
And kills him.
No, he doesn't. Or he could. Actually, I've never told him to kill him yet, but he just told him to kill him.
Okay, but does he told him ostensibly to do something to him on the mountain? It's all I'm pointing out is when it's reversed as Mara said by a malach, not by Hashem, and that's an important point. You probably learned that last Zman as to how that works and why that's important. That. Right, you can listen to Rabbi Wagensberg's shir on how Yitzchak really came back from the dead and all that kind of stuff. Right. Many of the Mephoreshim deal with that issue. The Ibn Ezra rejects it entirely as being completely unreasonable. But we'll see more from the Ibn Ezra in a minute. Rabbi Wagensberg didn't think of that. He presents it very beautifully, and it's an extremely worthwhile thing to listen to, and I recommend it strongly. But he didn't come up with the idea. It's very much part of the question marks that revolve around this discussion. Right. Let's get into the sheet. Can everybody please look at the sheet I gave you? Yael, did you get one? Wonderful. Does everyone have one? I don't want any more little hiatuses. Hiati? Whatever the word is. I doubt it. Okay. Now, I've called this class The Limits of Non-Literal Interpretation. And, you know, this is a topic which I think people have to get to grips with, because if you interpret too much non-literally, you end up throwing the entire Torah into some nice metaphoric, everything is just a metaphor for being a nice person, etc. On the other hand, if you don't interpret anything literally, you end up backing yourself into an impossible corner where you're having to defend things which are clearly impossible and not true, and therefore it has to be somewhere in the middle. And the question is where you draw that line, which is very, very difficult. Have a look at number one. The first point I've put here is as follows. Debei Rabbi Yishmael Tana, Ukapatish Yifotzetz Sala. The Torah is described like a hammer smashing into a rock. That's a pasuk in Yirmiyah. Says the Gemara, Ma Patish Ze Mitchalek Lekama Nitzotzot. Just like this hammer blow creates a large number of different sparks all flying out in different directions. Af Mikra Echad. Similarly, one verse, says the Gemara here, Yotze Lekama Ta'amim, can have multiple meanings. Therefore, the first source that I brought you here from the Gemara is a Gemara which alerts us to the fact that if you are looking at the Pesukim without understanding multiple meanings, then you are already misreading and misunderstanding Torah. This, of course, is the reason why it's almost impossible to have any understanding of Torah in a translation. Once you translate Torah into English, English becomes one-dimensional and therefore only communicates, if at all, that one message. So always the reason that you're at Midrash Rachel is to try and develop skills so that you can access Torah in the original and thereby have some way of connecting with the multiple layers, which again you cannot do in a foreign language as easily, if at all. And that, by the way, was one of the reasons why when the Torah was originally translated into Greek in the time of the Ptolemy, just after Alexander the Great, that was seen as being a great disaster for the Jewish people. Because what eventually you do is you take a very deep and multi-layered Torah and you turn it into just another book, which is just what you read and what you see is what you get, and there's nothing more than that. There is, by the way, something deeper, which I'll just alert you to as just an idea, which is actually very important, which is that the Jewish people, the Torah, has a radically different understanding of the nature of words than secular society, which is based on the Greek. The Greek understanding of the nature of words is that they're basically conventional, which means there's nothing intrinsic in them. If you study the understanding of what the logos, L-O-G-O-S, is in Greek thought, if you did any Greek philosophy when you were at university or whatever, that the logos doesn't describe the essence of the thing. It's just a mechanism to communicate an understanding of the nature of the form of the thing. But it's nothing about the thing itself. This is critically important, because Torah doesn't work that way. And until you get that clear, then you don't really know what they're trying to do when they're looking at Pesukim. The Pesukim work in a way, the Jewish perspective is that the word for a word, what's the word for a word in Hebrew?
Davar.
Davar, which is also the word for?
A thing.
The word for word and the word for thing are the same word. That's critical. Therefore, the word itself is an essence. And therefore, it can lend itself to different understandings, different meanings, gematrias. People think, oh, gematrias is just silly. Like, why are you giving all these numbers to these things? You add it up, you know, double it, square it, take off 15, and then add the number you first thought of, and bingo, you've got some, like, this proves that God exists. Like, that's not what gematrias are. If you try to do gematrias with English and say, what's the gematria of cat? Then, of course, it's ridiculous, because there is nothing to the word cat that has any intrinsic meaning at all. You could call cat a dog, you could call dog a cat. It wouldn't make any difference. Once you're dealing with a word that has an intrinsic meaning, then you're dealing with a whole different system, and that's a critical understanding to get to. Otherwise, you think, well, what are the rabbis doing? So you're getting so excited about the meaning you're looking for. That's the first point. Let's look at this story now. Number two. So these are psukim from the beginning of this week's parsha. Vayera elav Hashem, but Eloni Mamre. So God appeared to him in the tent of Mamre. Who Yosef Pesach Ha'ayel Tuchama Yom. He was sitting at the front of the tent in the heat of the day. So what's happening? Avram's sitting down, God's speaking to him. That's how the parsha opens. Why does God suddenly have this wonderful one-on-one chavrusa at this stage? What's Avram just done? Brit Milah. Brit Milah removes the barriers physically, and of course you're asking Tamar before, in what way the mitzvahs make a difference to the world to come. So of course the physical foreskin that Avram had was not only a physical block, but it represented a spiritual block, and as soon as he removes that, all of a sudden he's, you know, online full ADSL streaming audio whatever connection, and therefore, sorry to mix my metaphors dreadfully, but he's basically having this incredible experience now that he doesn't have a bris milah. He's now fully connected. The yisa einav vayar, he lifts up his eyes and he sees. Vehinei shloisha anashim nitzavim alav. There are three men standing by him. Vayar, and he saw, meaning he understood. Vayar actually crossed them, and he ran to meet them. And I've missed out the next bit because it's not important for what we do. In other words, he breaks off from God and goes to deal with these men. This is the end now. Vayakum misham ha'anashim. I mean, said Zayin in the second line. Then they got up. These men got up after they'd done all their talking and eating. Vayashkifu apnei stone. They looked down on stone. Avram hoylech imam l'shaltam. And Avram walks out with them to see them away. We learn all the halachas of hachnasas orchim, by the way, from this. Bringing people in, taking people out, what you serve them, how you serve them, all that.
Wait, I thought halacha could not be derived from anything before
Matan. Oh, I like it when students throw back at the things that I teach them. The answer is yes, you're absolutely right. We do not learn the obligation of hachnasas orchim from the Avram Avinu, because we cannot learn a mitzvah from anything that came before Har Sinai. However, given that we have the obligation after Har Sinai, where does it say, where in the Torah is there an obligation, a Torah mitzvah, to invite guests? Where do we see such a thing? Yeah, but in the Psukim? The answer is, V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha is the overarching mitzvah of all chesed mitzvahs. That includes Bikur Cholim, and Hachnasas Orchim, and Levaras Anais, and Hachnasas Kala, and Nichum Aveilim. Love your neighbour as yourself. It's in Parshas Kedoshim. It's in Vayikra Yutet Tet Vav or Tet Zayin. Well, you can say Vav if it's correct. Okay,
whoa,
you can look it up.
Whoa.
But I don't know if it's correct. Might have just made it up. Check it out. Vayikra Yutet 1916. Oh, 1916 again. Okay, so we'll see. Is it 1916? I may have just made that up. I may be completely wrong. I don't know.
It was where
the first one came. Maybe I'm wrong. It was where we're locked. Locked hesitating.
What was it
saying? Oh no, it's wrong. He's wrong. I thought he was wrong. So look one after one before.
What's that?
It's 1918. Okay, fine. Okay, so it's Melissa, it's Vayikra 19, Pasuk 18 is V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. Love your neighbor as yourself. Okay? I'm sure that quite a significant number of people in the street, if you ask them where does it say in the Bible, thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself, will quote something from the Gospel of Mark or whatever, Matthew. And the answer is, it does say things like that there too, but they're basically paraphrasing what it says already in Parshas Kedoshim, which is the mitzvah. So that's the mitzvah of Hachnasas Orchim. But the details of Hachnasas Orchim, that we can get from Avraham Avinu. Anyway, let's carry on. The Hashem Amar. Now God's still there. God seems to still be there. Hashem said, Hamachase ani me Avram, asher ani aseh. Can I hide from Avram what I'm going to do? Vayifnu mishama nashim, and then the men, the we later find out the malachim, turn from there. Vayelchus stoima, they go to stoima. Avraham odena omed lifnei Hashem, and Avram was still standing in front of God. The reason I brought you this pasukim is so you can see it doesn't seem that Avram ever left God. Avram was having this incredible relationship with God, and these three men came, and he ran around doing all this stuff. And then it says, and God said, "Can I hide from Avram what I'm going to do?" And the men left, and Avram was still, Odena, still standing before God. Vayigash Avram Yomer, and Avram stepped forward, and he said, "Ha'af tivset tzadikim rasha, are you going to kill the tzadik with the rasha?" And he has this whole argument with God about Sodom. And the very end, the last pasuk I brought you here is Vayomer, and he said, "Al na yichal la'ashem." Please don't be upset, annoyed. Va'adabra achapam. I'm going to speak one more time. Ulayim tsa'un sham asara. Maybe you'll find 10 people there. Va'yomer, and Hashem says, lo yashchis ba'avur ha'asara. I won't destroy it for 10 people. Va'yelech Hashem ka'ashe kila l'daber im Avram. And Hashem then left when he'd finished speaking with Avram. Va'avram shav l'makamo. And Avram goes back to his place. If you look at that peric as a whole, it looks very much like the whole thing is God and Avram together. And in the middle seems to be this little thing where there are three malachim running around, three people running around, he's running around after them, and Sarah, the laughing, and all that kind of stuff. And then it continues, God's with Avram, and he's speaking to him, having this conversation. Based on this, and based on a point of the interpretation of the psukim, the Rambam makes the following very interesting and we'll see somewhat controversial statement, which he says as follows. The entire episode of Bereshis, chapter 18, where Avram meets these three people, gives them this food, Sarah laughs, they have this conversation, and they have the promise that Yitzhak will be born, the entire thing happens only in Avram's head. The entire thing happens only in a nevuah, only in a prophecy, in a dream. In physical life, there were no people. There was no bread, there was no laughing, there was none of this. And it all happened as part of this incredible communion that Avram had with God. Part of that was this vision of three people and his wife laughing and people serving and eating food. Da, 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 da. You heard this before?
No.
Okay. Now, the Rambam I brought you in Mor Nevuchim in number 3 says what I just said. Have a look now in number 3. Wherever it says the Rambam, that a person sees a malach, I'm going to use the word malach. I don't like using the word angel, either because you think it's a bakery, or even worse, because you think it's a white fluffy thing with a halo and wings and, you know, cherubs and all that kind of stuff, which is not, nothing to do with that. So please eject all ridiculous sort of Christmas time angels from your head. This is a malach, okay? This is a malach, this is something different. Any time that a human being, says the Rambam, sees a malach, or pnia b'dibur mitzido, or has some kind of conversation with the malach, ze ach v'rak b'mareh ha'nevuah o b'chalom. This is only ever in a prophecy or in a dream. Bein im ze ne'emar mefureshes, whether it says so explicitly in the verses, Bain in law, whether it never says so explicitly in the verses. You know for absolute fact, and we'll see why the Rambam says this, that even if it doesn't say, even if it looks in the verses that there's a real person standing and talking to a real malach, it's happening on a level of nevuah. Kipishe igdam nuvamar, like we said previously in the Mor Nevuchim. V'da zois v'hevinu ma'oid ma'oid. He says, know this and understand it very, very well. Ein havdalim kosov b'tchila shirah es ha'malach. It doesn't matter whether originally it says he saw as a malach, or shehaya pshata kosov, or it looks like the pshat of the verse is shehu choshev oisav b'tchilas leben adam, or they thought he was a man. Sometimes people see malachim, they think they're people. It doesn't make any difference if it says it was a person. And then va'achrikem v'sofer shadavar, at the end of the thing, hitzbarer, it becomes evident lo shehu malach, that he's a malach. Kol zman she'at ha'motze she'sofer shadavar hu zizas yinira. At the end of the day, it turns out, if you saw a malach, or pan of a dibur, or you spoke to a malach, hayah malach, that it was a malach, as da, then you know for sure, el nachon shemitchilas ha-matzav ha-hu, you know that this situation, hayamara, is a vision, ha-nevuah in prophecy, or chalom shel nevuah, or a vision of a dream. Now, why does the Rambam say that? Emily?
Oh, that's not
what you were going to say?
I was I just had a question then, like, how can we derive halacha from something that never really actually happened?
Oh, well, first of all, you made a very interesting leap, and you said it never actually happened.
Physically happened.
Oh.
It didn't physically happen. He never physically brought bread to these malachim.
So what do you feel would be a more valid source of deriving halacha? Something from a direct communication with God in a nevuah, or something from someone's tea party? Actually, the truth is that I'm more likely to want to derive malacha from it if he had a vision and a nevuah from God. Okay? So that's an interesting point, but I think that actually goes the other way. The Ramban, Nachmanides, quotes the Rambam. The irony, of course, is that the Rambam in Morin Nevuchim, not many people learn Morin Nevuchim. And it's really kind of fallen out of favor. I mean, you go to the Mir Yeshiva, walk around the Mir Yeshiva and take a straw poll, how many people do a bit of Morin Nevuchim on the side? And the answer will be a very, very small number. Very small indeed. So no one would have ever really known this Rambam much if it hadn't been for the fact that the Ramban on Chumash, who everybody reads the Ramban on Chumash, is a very famous Perish, brings this Rambam in Morin Nevuchim, quotes him, and then tells you you're not allowed to believe this. Which is interesting and a bit of irony, because had he never mentioned it, no one probably would know about it. So we'll look at the Ramban now. Yael, you had a question?
I did. Designing the, for example, Bilam and the donkey, and with the Yeshua and the eighth of angels, is that also...
These are all examples that the Rambam in Morin Nevuchim gives as things that did not happen on a physical plane. The what? Not the Akedah. The bit where he spoke to an angel presumably was happening in a Nevuah. But that's not a difficult thing anyway, because the angel speaks from heaven and Avram listens, so we didn't think anything else than that. It's not as if it says in the Akedah that a man suddenly appeared next to Avram and said, don't do this. It does already say that if there's a voice comes out of heaven, so that's less of a problem. No one suggests that the Akedah itself was a like non-physical thing. But Bilam, the Rambam says explicitly, the donkey wasn't speaking. Bilam was suddenly picking up this voice which was coming in a Nevuah, which he connects with the donkey. Similarly, when Yaakov has a wrestling match with a Malach, says the Rambam, this wrestling match happened entirely in his own Nevuah to prepare him for his next day meeting with Esav. Similarly, when Mrs. Manoach, Shimshon's mother and father, have this vision of a Malach, again, says the Rambam, they're not talking to a real guy sitting there. And everything that's happening, when Gidon has a vision with the Malach, it's all happening in a Nevuah.
Everything with the Malach, including... But the thing is, two things. One is that if it's all happening in his head or if it's a Nevuah,
right,
then why is it that he was physically affected by the sciatic nerve?
Right. Okay. There's two things
that's
you said.
One.
Yes.
And then two is that, does that also include when Yaakov took all the stones and put it by his head and then was jumped about the angels? We know that was for sure that he was sleeping or had Nevuah.
Yes.
Or something, but more specifically about the physical. Is it also the mind-body connection where the way a person thinks, if a person thinks about whatever, it actually can manifest in a physical form?
So you're answering your question.
I know, but I'm saying is that
the so case, funnily, it's
so much so in that area, because that's like a very hard like area to go down and like
that's very interesting
energy and nerves and like to even to the point where he's limping, like that's pretty extreme.
Well, it is pretty extreme. The Ritva, who is a defender of the Rambam against a lot of attack, saying you can't say this, you can't learn this, it's not correct. The Ritva raises the question that you asked: how could it be that Yaakov was limping? Well, he didn't raise that question; he quotes that question. But he answers the answer that you gave, which is that when you have any kind of intense internal psychosomatic is the manifestation, but when you have any intense mental experience, it does manifest in a physical way. You never woke up from a nightmare panting and sweating. Why are you manifesting physically? You're running away in this dream from someone that's running after you, and suddenly you wake up kind of... You know, there's why are you in a runner? You've been lying in bed. Why are you sweating and panting? The answer is your body is responding to a mental image of running, etc., etc., and your mind has made it real. That this is a very deep and interesting subject. Okay.
It's because the thing that's the function of the muscles. You know, the muscles fasting, that's how people get knocked.
Right.
But, same thing with clenching.
Right. So in other words, this question is not a new question, but you can see where already people are going to start to get a bit nervous about this whole methodology of interpretation. Like, where does it end? The Ramban, one second, I'm not going to read through the whole quote, number four, but the Ramban raises a number of questions. He says, well, where does the vision stop? What about Lot? These three angels. Did Lot see this in a vision as well? Was that not real? What about the people that crowded around the house?
Yeah, exactly.
Were they not real? When Sodom was destroyed, was that real or was that not real? Was Lot just imagining it was real? Where does the dream end and the reality begin? And the Ramban gets into these interesting questions, which in many ways are very sort of modern questions. They're very postmodern almost questions as to what is real, what is existentialism, what, you know, am I really or do I only think that I am, and maybe if I think, therefore I am. And there's the whole question there, the Cartesian understanding of the way the world works, this is really what's kind of going on. But from a perspective of Chumash analysis, the Ramban is very upset. And if you look at the very end here, you'll see, he says in bold, yeah, ve'ele dvarim soisrim hakosav, these things that the Rambam, Maimonides, is saying, contradict the Psukim. For goodness sake, the Psukim say that there was a pea person and he ate a cake, and the Sarah was laughing. Asur lishma l'shem am, you're not allowed to listen to such things. Af ki laham in behem, you're not allowed to believe them. So he quotes the Rambam and says, you're not allowed to listen, or you're not allowed to believe it. That's it. So what's going on here? Do we what? Most people's view of this particular issue will be more in line in the modern day with Nachmanides, but that wasn't the case at the time of the Rambam. We're going to see soon why that was the case. Oh, very good. Where did the Rambam get this from? Like, who gives the Rambam the right to turn around and take an explicit verse, right? He's the Rambam. But that's a very good question, which leads us directly to source number five. And since you asked the question, Melissa, you can read it. Yeah. No, they were all Sephardim. He was a doctor. He was also a doctor.
But I mean, in terms of like other things, was he also a physicist? Was he also delved into philosophy?
Ella's putting her finger on a very interesting thing, which is, really, if we wanted to make a bit of a study of this, we would actually take a number of different areas in Hashkofa and Halacha, or Hashkofa really, where the Ramban and the Rambam disagree, and try and work out, see if we can see what happened. Both of them came from Spain. They were 100 years apart. What happened? The historical answer is that there was basically something of a backlash against philosophy, against rationalism, and a turn in the Sephardi world much more towards Kabbalah, towards mysticism, and that really happened as the golden age of Spain ended, and the position of the Spanish Jews began to descend into a very uncomfortable and persecuted one. By the last 200 years of this, if the Jews came to Spain in around, let's say, the year 700, 800, the first 200 or 300 years were amazing. The last 200 years were pretty bad, and the last 50 to 100 years were awful, to the point when eventually they got expelled, and there was a Spanish expulsion, the Spanish Inquisition, etc. What happened is, this is around the turning point, and the Ramban's philosophy very much reflects a more mystical, non-rational, Kabbalistic understanding, which the Rambam was not very much part of. But the world of the Rambam, in the world of the Rambam, he was not the only voice. We'll see this is a position which is taken by a number of other people from that sort of time, and indeed afterwards as well. And for us as modern people, one of the most important aspects of this debate is well, we are secularly educated, we like rational things, we like the world of the Rambam. Yeah, it's not a coincidence that the modern Orthodox world is very into the Rambam. Okay? Because the Rambam is kind of a new man. He's the kind of person that you could imagine, and of course this is ridiculous in a sense, but he's the kind of person you could imagine lecturing in a university. Whereas, of course, it's a ridiculous thing to say, but you know what I'm talking about. He's the kind of person that you can associate with critical analysis and modern techniques. He's an intellectual. That's not to say that the Rambam was not an intellectual, but he was coming from a very different place. And therefore, part of the modern Orthodox Haredi sort of tension is not just about silly things like politics and what kind of hat you wear. That's ridiculous. Deep down, it's about more important things like, do we go for a rationalist understanding of the world or a non-rationalist understanding of the world? And how far is that going to make us change the way we look at psukim, change the way we look at halachas, and change the way we look at chazal, etc., etc., etc. Change the way we look at rabbis. Are rabbis mystical figures that can grant blessings and you know, give us brochas, or are rabbis intellectual and guides to help us through life when we make our own decisions? This is manifest in many, many ways. Yeah.
And it seems as if the Rambam's interpretation in more developed
is
that it seems a bit esoteric. It seems as
though
he's not saying it's literal, but in fact he's giving
right.
different ideas.
Right.
So it seems it's just
the opposite. Well, you're assuming that rational means literal. It could be that rational requires you to take non-literal understandings of the psukim when they don't make sense. And therefore we'll see that right now. Why don't you flip over the page, Melissa, and read for us number 5. Number 5 is something that you probably haven't ever really looked at before. It is a sefer from the Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon lived a couple of hundred years before the Rambam. Okay? He lived in Egypt. He was really one of the initial founders of a more rationalist understanding of the way mitzvahs work and the reasons for mitzvahs, etc. And what he tries to do here is give us some guidelines as to when we do and when we don't take sukkim literally. So why don't you read for us now and see how we get on?
It is a well-known fact that every statement found in the Bible is to be understood in its literal sense, except for those that cannot be construed for one of the following
reasons. Right, so what's his opening position? Right, that you must understand things literally. Whenever you see something written in a verse, you have to assume the default position is literal. By the way, we are not here dealing with Midrashim. Midrashim is an entirely different conversation, and the default position in Midrashim, according to pretty much everybody, has to be that the Midrashim are not meant to be literal, unless there's a good reason for them to be literal. Okay, I shouldn't say pretty much according to everybody, but according to many, even in the perhaps more non-rational perspective, Midrashim are not designed to be literal understandings of this happened, then this happened, then this happened. Psukim, on the other hand, are, says the Rav Sadia Gaon, meant to be literal unless there's a good reason for it to not be. And he's going to give us 4 reasons. Let's look at the reasons first and then we can go forward.
Okay, it may be, for example, either be rejected by the observation of the senses, such as the statement, and the man called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all living things. Whereas we see that the ox and the lion are not the offspring of womankind.
In other words, it's poshut. It says that Chava was called Chava. It comes from the name Chaya. It was the name Chava because she was the mother of all living things. Well, she's not the mother of all living things, obviously. She's the mother of all living people. So, yeah, but you know what it means. The answer is, well, yes, you're taking it non-literally, because it's obvious it makes no sense to pretend that Chava is the mother of lions and tigers and bears. Exactly. Therefore, I don't think there's anything particularly controversial in that. Nobody is going to take that literally. Rav Sadia Gaon is just pointing out that's one reason not to take it literally if it's clearly rejected by the observation of the senses. Although I would put out there, how far does that go?
Mm-hmm.
What about the observation of science? What happens if we observe around us that the universe is hundreds of millions of years or billions of years old, and then the Torah tells us it was made in 6 days? Is that also called the observation of the senses? Or is that not called the observation of the senses?
What do you call the observation of the senses? That seems natural to you, like what governs the world?
Well, his example is we see that human beings don't give birth to animals. Therefore, when it says that Chava gave birth to all living creatures, it's obvious to us from what we see all around us that that cannot be literal. Is it obvious to us from the world around us that the world cannot be 5,700 years old? And you may argue that it is obvious, because when you chop down trees and you count the number of rings, there are trees with many more than 5,700 rings. I mean, is that the observation of the senses around us? Maybe?
I mean, not simple
simplifying it down to the tree thing, but like other sophisticated tests that have been developed, yes, they would completely indicate the world is way more than that around.
Absolutely. And others, short of turning around and saying either that the science is wrong, yeah, or that the science is right and the world was made that way to fool us, and it looks old but it's really not old, which we'll talk about when we have a class on this. Short of saying that, then you're going to have to turn around and say that the word day doesn't really mean day.
Well, but how could you say day when it's scientific terms of day is relative to the sun, because the sun isn't even created till day four?
That's another good reason why day doesn't make sense. It calls day, day on day one, two, and three, and that doesn't make any sense for the concept of day.
So also you can say that the plant appeared on day three, but to our knowledge, plants can't grow without sunlight.
So these are all good reasons why it could be. I'm not saying Rav Sadia Gaon says this, but I'm saying that it could be that this first thing says that the first reason is that it's perfectly legitimate to take Sukkim in a non-literal way if they just don't make sense in any other way from the perspective of what we see all around us. Okay, carry on. No, you just gone back a line.
Hence it is logically and invisible that God resembles it.
You understand what he's saying?
No.
God, the psukim called God, very honest, the psukim called God fire. Fire is obviously something which you can light and you can extinguish. Therefore, fire by definition is physical, is energy, is finite, and therefore how can God be really like fire? Therefore, when it says God is like Aish, it doesn't mean Aish. It means something else. It just used the word Aish to communicate something about God. And we'll see that in more detail soon. Okay, that's another, but that's nothing to do with what we perceive. That's a rational concept. It's not rational to us that God can be limited, because the God that we understand from Judaism, from the Torah Shabbat Peh, from everything, is an unlimited God. Therefore, every time it turns in the psukim that God is limited, I'm going to have to take that in a non-literal way. God has arms, legs, eyes, anger, happiness. Well, these are all going to have to be non-literal expressions. Yeah? Three.
Okay. By an explicit text of a contradictory nature, in which case it would become necessary to interpret the first statement in a non-literal sense.
Meaning, if it says one thing in one place, and then somewhere else it says something completely different, then obviously, if the two don't go together, one of them is going to have to give. And therefore, the Torah itself is asking to be taken in a logical way, and we're going to see an example of that. Carry on.
Okay. Finally, any biblical statement, the meaning of which rabbinic tradition has attached to certain reservations, is to be interpreted by us in keeping with biblical authentic tradition. Thus, it has been transmitted to us that the punishment of stripes consists of 39 blows, although the scripture states 40 stripes.
In other words, he says very often, and we're going to see this in the halakhic sense very, very often, the Torah says one thing and means something completely different, because our tradition, the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, tells us that that's not what it means. An eye for an eye, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk, etc., etc., etc. He says there we don't have any problem taking the Torah not literally. In fact, on the contrary, we very much don't take it literally, and if you do take it literally, you're perverting Judaism. So carry on.
There exist, then, only these four possible reasons for a non-literal interpretation of the verses of the sacred writ, there being no fifth.
Oh, he's very insistent that that's it. Four, and only four, and there isn't a fifth. I'm not aware of anyone else who gives us a kind of guideline, like the Rav Sadia Gaon did, as to when you can and when you cannot call the verses literal. So again, just to summarize before we go on, he says there are four reasons why you can turn around and say this verse is not literal. Number one, we see with our own eyes that this is not what happens. People don't give birth to animals. Number two, it makes no sense that this, rationally, that this can be the case. God has arms and eyes and legs. Number three, it makes no sense together with other psukim which contradicts it directly. And number four, the rabbis themselves came along and told us that we were not meant to take this verse literally. If it doesn't fit into one of those four categories, then you must assume that it is literal. Now, based on those, why do you feel that the Rambam turned around and said that Avram never really had a meal with the angels? Which of those does it fit into?
I don't know.
Maybe.
Angels can have human form.
How do you know?
Because...
we don't have rational senses when it comes to this. This goes against my rational beliefs that an angel is going to come down to eat with me.
So you're saying it's number two?
Yeah.
It's not rational. It goes against reason that a malach can sit and have dinner with you. Why?
But this all goes against the reason.
What do you mean, it all? What's that statement
like
mean?
How do you interact Torah with your rationale?
Why? Don't do things to other people that you wouldn't want them to do for you. Why is that not rational? 95% of that. What is irrational about the concept of sitting and having a meal with a malach?
Well, it's, why is it irrational that God has
arms?
It's not. That's another example. They're spiritual, that's not. They are beings from a completely different plane of existence. But there's when it turns around to eat with Yaakov and it says, Yaakov spoke to Rachel and Rachel said this and Yaakov answered that. Is there any reason why I shouldn't take that literally? That there was no man, there was no such person as Yaakov? No, of course. Because there's no reason why there cannot be a man called Yaakov and a woman called Rachel, and he can say this to her and she can say this to him. Whereas there is a very good reason, the Rambam's going to say, why you cannot have dinner with a spiritual being. Because dinner and spiritual don't go together. Can I trouble you, Emily, for another glass of water?
Wait, then I go back to the question. It's kind of the same question I asked on the Rambam. When I asked on the skipper and
right.
But how does he know that God didn't want to take it literally?
Right. Which one? Which one don't you like? One, two, or three, or four? Well, no, some of them, you couldn't have it any other way. For example, number four,
right,
where the rabbis turn around and say it's not spiritual, how does he know that we're allowed to listen to the rabbis? Well, that's easy, because it tells you in the Torah to listen to the rabbis.
Right.
Fine. So we dealt with number four. Right. Number two, you know, when it goes against all rationale, and the only way we can take the pasuk literally is by saying that God really does have arms and legs, how do I know I'm not meant to say that? The answer is because it flies in the face of a fundamental Jewish hashkafa.
Right.
Unless, of course, you really do believe that God has arms.
I don't know, but maybe he does. He's never showed himself to us. Maybe he's arms and legs. How do I know?
That's a good point. You're making the assumption. We're assuming that God cannot possibly have arms and legs, okay, and therefore making the pasukim fit that assumption.
Right.
Maybe God does have arms and legs.
But we know that there's 15 principles that's coming through. If we believe that Hashem is undivided and is not.
Oh, it's chicken and egg.
Why is it chicken and egg? It's not chicken and egg.
And does not have a body or a form. Or
but yet, she grabs a form.
Really? Can God make a stone that he can't lift up? That's the classic formulation of the question you're asking. If God can make a stone that he can't lift up, then God's limited. And if God can't make a stone that he can't lift up, then he's limited. So either way, God's limited. That's the classic formulation. The reason why that formulation doesn't work is because it's not logical to ask God to do something that by definition God cannot be. Because if you're, it's like saying, can God make a triangle into a circle? So if you turn around and say, God can't make a triangle into a circle, then not, you have a limited God. But the answer is no. Once you make a triangle into a circle, there's not a triangle anymore. By definition, a triangle cannot be a circle. It cannot be a circle. And therefore, you cannot say, well, that God's not good enough because he can't do that. And that's part of the whole discussion. Because by definition, what is a malach? A malach is a spiritual manifestation of God, which is a little bit more concretized. But nevertheless, it's not part of the spiritual, the physical world in any sense. It interacts with other malachim, with other malachim, with other malachim, with other malachim, until eventually something physical falls out of the bottom of the chain. But at the end of the day, it's a spiritual thing.
Right.
How can a spiritual thing have physical form?
I don't know. That's a good question. But
aren't we spiritual? We have physical form.
Well, you see, you're assuming that you're spiritual in a physical way, that your spiritual and your physical go together. Maybe you're looking at it with a very Kabbalistic, maybe Hasidic even understanding, that your spiritual you and your physical you are intertwined and knitted together. The Rambam might not see it that way.
Maybe my spiritual self is somewhere else?
Yes, absolutely. The Rambam's understanding of your neshama is not that it's somehow deeply inside yourself. Yeah. It's that your neshama exists in an entirely separate parallel universe, which is a spiritual universe, and somehow interacts with your body, somehow, which we're not going to get into exactly how that works. Derech Hashem is coming from a specific perspective.
Right.
Now, I'm saying that this is why I started off this class saying there are often two, from Tamar's question, there are often two really different ways of looking at any specific thing. And one of them is a rationalist and one of them is a non-rationalist. Now, rationalist doesn't mean that you cannot believe in spirituality. Spirituality is rational. It's not, it's just that mysticism is different. And therefore, from one perspective, you could understand that the neshama is completely detached from the body, only interfacing on some kind of, I don't know, remote control level, I don't know how that works exactly. But it's not like deep inside you, and it goes to the question, where is God in the world at all? Is the world real or is the world virtual? Is the world really all God? Okay? In which case we're living in a matrix, which makes it look as though we're real, but actually the whole thing is just raw spirituality. Or is the world real and it's this is you know, real bits of wood, and there is a spiritual existence willing this table into being, but it's not inside the table. In any
sense.
Oh, come on. You should know by now. You can't say, what's the answer?
Depends
on your perspective.
Why are they disagreeing with each other?
Why? Because Elu ve'elu dibre elokim chayim. There are different perspectives. We will deal with this. Now, let's go into detail a little bit on some of these issues. Yes?
Where did he get these four categories? Like,
I don't know. He formulated them.
He's the first... What's literal and what's not.
I don't know, why is anyone who comes up with any formulation for the first time, where did he get that from? I think most of them he gets from his understanding of Judaism, from his Masorah, and from looking in the Talmud. But you're right, he
So
we're going to see a little bit afterwards what the answer to maybe that last question. Look, just let me take you quickly through a couple of other issues. Literal readings negated by our senses. I've brought a few other ones as well. There are clearly psukim which are clearly not meant to be taken literally, because they just don't make any sense by our senses. Number six. Ana anachno oylim achenu hamasu es levavenu lemor am gadol v'ram mimenu. He's talking about the Canaanites. What are you going to say about the Canaanites? They're a great people. Arim gdolot, they have great cities. Ubitzorot bashamayim, they are fortified all the way up to the sky. You with me? They are fortified all the way up to the sky. Gam b'nei anakim ra'inu sham, and there are giants there. In other words, obviously everyone knows that there are cities fortified up to the sky. When I say that the city is fortified all the way up to the heavens, It's just a turn of phrase. It's just an expression. Similarly, when it says number seven, Umaltem es orlas levavchem, you must cut off the foreskin of your hearts. Then I know what that means. That's like we know from our everyday senses that we don't have foreskins on our hearts. Okay. Therefore, the posuk is not telling us to cut foreskins off our hearts, because it must be telling us something more metaphorical, and therefore these are easy cases where the psukim obviously are not meant to be literal. Nobody, I think, would ever suggest that they were meant to be literal. You have to start carving things into your, you know, into your heart. Yes.
So when we speak of, I think there's different sections where I'm not sure if it ties in with homosexuality, but with stoning people, like they really did stone people back then, right? So was that supposed to be taken literal or non-literal?
So again, does when it says in the Torah, and you have a mitzvah to stone people in certain circumstances, does that fit into any of these four categories or upside gone, which would indicate to us that that's not meant to be taken literally? And the answer is no, it doesn't. It's perfectly rational to be able to see. You might not agree with it, just like you might not agree that pork should be trade. That's different. But there's nothing irrational about punishing somebody by stoning, okay? There's nothing against it in the rabbinic tradition that says you're not allowed to do that. There's nothing from our senses that means that cannot possibly happen. And there's nothing elsewhere in the Torah that contradicts it. But yes, we don't take that line metaphorically, meaning, I don't know, you have to stoning people means you have to make them feel the weight of their terrible acts until they never want to do it again. Doesn't mean that. It means you throw stones at them until they die. Actually, doesn't actually mean that either, because the actual way that they did stone people was not by throwing stones at them. But I'm not getting into that now. If you want to look at it, it's in detail in the Gemara in Sanhedrin and the Rambam Paschas in Halacha, how exactly the execution by stoning took place, and you can look that up. Yeah, I must go on because I don't want to go late. Yeah. Alright, so let's just wait a little bit. B, literal readings where other verses point out that things don't work the same way. So I brought you an example. It says in the chapter 1 of Bereishit that God created man and woman. And in chapter 2 it says that God created man and woman was taken off the side of man. two completely contradictory verses. So what happened? Did God create man and woman? Or did God create man and then detach woman from man? And Rashi explains that the second verse is how it happened. God created man and detached woman. Whatever that means, I'm not getting into it now. And the first chapter of Bereshit was just a summary of how the whole thing happened. He created men and women, and later on we'll go and tell you how he did it. But it's not that he created men and women, and then later... Now, this is not the only way of understanding that whole thing, and there's a whole discussion about who was the first woman, and where did she go, and all that kind of stuff. That's not for now. C is very much more where it's all happening. Have a look in C. When do the rabbis tell us not to read verses literally? When? So the answer is, in halakhic texts, all the time. All the time. For example, number 9, Loisav Hashel Gediba Chalevi Moi, do not cook a kid in its mother's milk, becomes do not cook meat and milk together and eat them. Don't cook them, don't eat them, don't get benefit from them, etc. Number 10, it says if someone breaks into your house in the middle of the night and you don't know if they're going to kill you, are you allowed to fight back and kill them? Says the Torah, Im Zarcha Hashemesh Alav, if the sun is shining on the intruder, okay, Shalem Yishalem, sorry, damim loy shalem shalem. And you murder the guy, then you're guilty of murder. If the sun is shining on him. What do you mean if the sun is shining on him? Chazal said, it means if it's clear, if it's clear, crystal clear as sun in the day, that the guy is not going to be prepared to kill you, then if you murder him, or if you kill him in self-defense, quote unquote, then you're the murderer, not him. Okay? Whereas if it's not clear that he's going to kill you, maybe he will, maybe he won't, then you're entitled to preempt his actions and kill him first because you don't know. But it all comes from these words, if the sun is shining. Doesn't nothing to do with the sun, it's nothing to do with shining. Chazal said this verse means something else. Number 11, this is the situation we had a few weeks ago, which a couple of you were a bit excited about, I remember. It talks about if a man says Lashon Hara about a woman that he marries, and he says she wasn't a virgin, and therefore he wishes to divorce her, and what's more, he claims that she had an affair, and that's why she's not a virgin, and therefore she would be guilty herself of adultery. It says in the Psukim that the family of the girl will bring in the sheet and will spread the sheet in front of the court. What sheet? What's the sheet talking about? And Chazal say, there's no sheets going on here. What you've got to take, blood-stained sheets and find them, that's completely unreliable. There could be a million reasons why a blood-stained sheet is completely unreliable. It doesn't mean anything to do with sheets. It means you will spread out the evidence as clearly as you possibly can, and each side will bring evidence in the court proceeding, and you'll find out that the girl is innocent, and then you'll send the guy away and tell him that he's the one that's guilty, not her.
What kind of evidence?
You can bring in evidence from witnesses of different kinds. How are you going to bring evidence that somebody's a virgin?
I have no idea.
So that's an interesting question. Character witnesses. I'm not sure that would be classic evidence.
Not witnesses, but like, what else?
You could turn around and say, he got engaged to her on September the 3rd. Okay, and they got married on October the 15th. And she could bring witnesses to say that she was together on a desert island with two other women, and that's where they've been, and they just came to the wedding now. And obviously, if he says that she had an affair with someone, he's obviously lying.
Okay.
That would be good evidence that she can't possibly have committed adultery in the intervening period. I don't know, I just made that up. You can make up all sorts of things that there could be evidence that she can't possibly have committed adultery. How do you ever bring evidence in a case that someone did or did not commit an act of murder, adultery? Yeah, an alibi.
I didn't realize that I thought it was just a general accusation of her being a virgin and not...
No, it's nothing to do with her being a virgin.
A specific time period where she...
If somebody marries a woman and he says, I thought she was a virgin and she didn't turn into being a virgin, then there's no suggestion that she's adulterous. It's just a suggestion that they didn't understand their respective positions before they got married. Which, you know, maybe he could argue that you tricked me when we got married. And that's a different suggestion. That's more of a, like, an interpersonal monetary almost situation. But that's nothing to do with adultery, obviously. Fine. So there are many, many halakhic situations where that comes up. Now, just flip over to page 3 for a second. There is... I don't want to take us over time. We'll finish around about 3:25, hopefully. But there is definitely, however, an acknowledgement in the Gemara that there are two levels to this. There's drash and there's pshat. So when the rabbis are talking about halachic understandings of psukim, they are not talking about pshat. They are talking on a level that we call drash. Okay? And therefore this is a good example of where the psukim are working, if you like, at two levels. When we're asking, is the literal meaning of the psukim, are these psukim not to be taken literally at all? And then we bring a posuk and say, well, look, the rabbis say that this means this. They're not talking about the literal meaning of the psukim. They're just talking about the deeper halachic level of the psukim. And that's why there's a whole discussion number 12, which raises the very, very famous quote, where Chazal are having a discussion about a particular area, I'm not getting into it now, in Hilchos Shabbos, and one of them comes up with a comment, Ein mikra yotza lidei pshuta. That at the end of the day, no matter what you do with drash, there's always going to be a pshat level to the psukim. There's always going to be a quote-unquote literal, but it's not really literal, a surface-level understanding. What does the word pshat mean? See, it doesn't really mean simple, because there's nothing simple about pshat. If it was simple, why do we have all these commentaries all around the Chumash trying to understand what the pshat is? Everything in here is pshat. Nothing in here is looking at drash. Is it surface? Again, that implies a level of kind of almost kind of superficiality.
Straightforward.
So they suggest the word pashta. Pashta means flowing. Okay?
Pashtida,
it's spelled differently. That's with a tap, I think, not a tet. And I'm not sure that's a Hebrew word, I think it might be Arabic. But anyway, but that is quiche, you're absolutely right. Can't fault you on that complete statement. The point is like this. Pashta, I want to translate pshat like this. Pshat means the way the verse flows in a grammatical context, in a contextual, you know, situation that fits with the worlds of grammar, etc. So whereas drash is much more of a deeper understanding of things. So we're really asking a question not in drash, we're really asking a question in pshat. Do we ever find where we say the pshat is taken in a completely non-literal way? Not the drash. The drash is no chiddush. It's no chiddush to say that the drash is not literal. Everyone says the drash is not literal. Okay? And very often you have two different layers. For example, Yaakov, you mentioned Yaakov Avinu. He takes 12 stones and put them around his head. Okay? And then the next morning when he wakes up after his dream, what happened? There's one stone. How do you explain that anomaly?
Well,
he threw the other ones away. So, yeah, so the Midrashic answer, Rashi brings two answers. Actually, Rashi brings one answer. He brings only the Midrashic answer, which is that in the middle of the night, all the stones were arguing about, we want to be the one that Yaakov Avinu sleeps on, and no, we want to be the one that Yaakov Avinu sleeps on. And then the next morning, they'd all merged into one stone. Now, is that pshat?
No.
Absolutely not. Although Rashi brings it, which raises the question as to, well, what's Rashi doing? Is Rashi looking for pshat, or is Rashi not looking for pshat? That's way off topic for today. Well, it's not way off, but it's a bit beyond what I want to get into. But that's a midrashic idea. Nobody, I don't think, suggests literally the psukim mean that he took 12 stones and they all merged into one. That midrash obviously is a very beautiful idea. 12 tribes of Israel fighting with each other, merging into one, becoming Klal Yisrael, etc., etc. What is the pshat of those psukim? It says when he took from the stones of the place, it means he took one of the stones. From the stones. It doesn't say he took lots of stones. He took from the stones, and so he had a stone. And the next morning you see that was the stone he had. He only ever had one stone. So there's a pshat meaning, and there's a drash meaning. What about the pshat being non-literal? So I want you to look at in this last little bit, just on the top of page 4. There's more material here than we can cover in one session. But we sometimes see that the rabbis themselves indicate that there's not even a pshat level which is literal. Forget about drash. And one of the interesting type places that this comes up is in the book of Job. Remember the book of Job? The book of Job is about a very unfortunate man who had great blessings in life and lost everything. He loses his family, he loses his money, he loses his health, his body is afflicted. And basically he is, and the spotlight is to see how does he deal with this suffering and how do people around him advise him as to how to deal with this suffering. And the whole book is a very long and detailed analysis of this. So the Gemara in Bava Basra has a very interesting discussion. Who was Job? When did he live? What an interesting guy. Did he live at the time of Moshe? Did he live later? Etc. So look what it says in number 17. Yosef Ahumer Rabbonim, one of the rabbis came, was sitting learning, Kameid Rav Shmuel Bar Nachmeni, in front of Rav Shmuel Bar Nachmeni. But Yosef Ahumer, he made the following comment. Eov, Job, Loi Haya, Veloi Nivra. He didn't ever exist. Ela Moshel Haya. The whole thing is a moshel. It's a moshel. Says the in the parable. It's a made up story to explain the nature of suffering. So the rabbi Rav Shmuel Bar Nachmani says to him, Amalei, Alecha Amakra, Ish Haya Be'eretz Utz. But it says there was a man from the land of Utz. Okay. Eov Shmon, his name was Job. So what are you telling me was a marshal? It's not a story. It's not a made-up story. It's about a man. To which the student says, Elame Ata, if that's the case, what about the story in Shmuel Bet when it says, Ula Rash, Ein Loi Ki Im Kivsa Echad? Okay, Katana, Asher Kana V'Yichya, etc. It tells you, remember the story with David and Bathsheba? Remember the story, David sleeps with Bathsheba.
Mm-hmm.
And Nathan, Hanavi, God sends Nathan to David. Yeah, it's God or not? It's God or Nathan?
What?
Yeah, he sends it's Nathan. No, yeah. Sends him to talk to him, and he says to him, he makes up this whole story. There was a poor man, and he only had one sheep. And the sheep meant everything to him. And along came a rich man. He took the sheep away, etc., etc. What should we do to the rich man? David said, "Yeah, kill him." He said, "The rich man's you." And the whole thing. So who was that poor man who only had one sheep? Obviously, there was no such poor man who only had one sheep. The whole thing is just a moshel in order to teach David a melech a lesson. So he says, so too, Eov, the whole thing is just a moshel. Are you telling me the psukim never speak in mashalim? It's a moshel. Mihava, who was that? This poor man didn't exist. And a moshel ba'alma. Hachanami moshel ba'alma. Here also, Job is also a moshel. The Rav answers it in Cain Shmoy v'Shem Iroi Lama. So why does the Torah, why does the book of Job go into all the details about the name and the places, etc., etc.? And the Gemara leaves it at that. It doesn't answer that question. What we see from this Gemara is very interesting, is that the rabbis entertain the idea that one of the entire books of the Bible, which talks about people and places and things and events, the whole thing is actually, and it says it as if it really happened, the whole thing never really happened at all. And therefore, this is an example, a good example that the Rav Sadigon would give as to when the rabbis themselves gave an indication that something can be read in a non-literal way. I think that's something of a classic example. The last thing I brought here, was this business of reason, and the Rambam I think is using this as to why he understands you cannot speak with an angel in a physical sense. I brought you a quote in 18 and 19 from the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah and in the Mor Nevuchim, where he explains this concept, which is very interesting. Of, I don't know if you've ever heard this before. I put it in bold in number 18. Look in bold in number 18. That Al Hakol. He's talking about anthropomorphisms. The Rambam saying when he says that God has arms and legs and eyes, etc. Why did he use that language? Why did he use language that's incorrect? So he says the famous words. He's quoting them from Chazal, though he's using them in a slightly different way. The Al Hakol in bold in number 18. On all of this, Amru Chachamim. The Chachamim explained like this: Dibra Torah Koloshen Bnei Adam. The Torah speaks in the language of people. What does that mean, the Torah speaks in the language of people? What does that mean? Right, it means, at least when it comes to anthropomorphism, don't expect the Torah to be giving you an accurate, literal understanding. It's using language which is inaccurate in order to convey meaning to people, to everyday, normal people. Look at number 19. Says the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, Masha Amru Dibra Torah Koloshen Bnei Adam. Mashmaos Hadamah, what does that mean? Shekol Masha Bnei Adam Kula Mesugalim Lahavino. It's the kind of idea that people, normal people, are able to grasp. Uletzairoi, and to imagine, the Machshava Rishona, in the first understanding of their minds. In other words, you cannot communicate in a word that God is, you know, unlimited and, you know, one great unity, etc. You have to say things like God sees. Just like you have to say God's happy, or God's sad, or God's angry, or God regrets this. And of course it's all not true. How can God be happy and sad? God doesn't have mood swings. These things are inaccurate ways of describing something which cannot have parts. Therefore, but nevertheless it speaks B'loshon Bnei Adam. There was someone called, you probably never heard of, called Yosef Ibn Kaspi. One of the Rishonim called Rav Yosef Ibn Kaspi. Anyone ever heard of him? There's a lot of Ibn's. There's a lot of Ibn's around. They're all basically, you know, Arabic bends. Yeah. Yosef Ibn Kaspi takes this principle of Dibra Torah B'Lashon B'nei Adam, and he says this is true of many aspects of the Torah, not just about anthropomorphism. The Torah expresses things in ways which are like normal, but don't expect them to be accurate in every respect. And therefore you cannot turn around and say that every single thing you read has literal meaning. Now, what are the limits of Ibn Kaspi? So that's a good question. I brought you a quote in number 20 from two paragraphs from an essay by Rabbi Isidore Twersky. Anyone know who Rabbi Isidore Twersky is?
Yeah.
Rabbi Isidore Twersky, he's no longer alive. He was the son-in-law of Rav Soloveitchik. Okay? And his sons teach in various places. One is a Rosh Hashiva in YU. One is a Rav here in Yerushalayim. And if you know Riverdale at all? Community?
Yeah.
Riverdale community in Manhattan? It's up there? So his daughter married the Rav there, Rav Rosenblatt? Something like that. Anyway, he's a whole family very involved. I advise you, he was a professor at Harvard, Rabbi Twersky, a very clever guy. And he talks about Ibn Kaspi here. And I'll leave you to read that on your own and see how far that might go. And the last thing I want you to just look at, and then we'll finish in 3 minutes, is over on the last page. This is really what Mara asked, and this is what we'll finish with. What's Rav Saadia Gaon concerned about? Why does he draw this line in these four places? Or maybe it was Melissa that asked. Why does he draw the line here and say that so far but no further? And you can read this on your own later, but he basically says... Actually, let's read the first paragraph. Someone read the beginning of 21 and then we'll finish. Someone volunteer? Yeah, please, nice and loud. Writ, whatever. I just used his translation, I didn't want to change it, that's all.
In whatever figurative sense is possible without compelling proof, not a single revealed law would be maintained that they're all capable of non literal interpretation.
What does he mean?
Reformed Judaism.
Basically, Reformed Judaism. He basically, and of course he lived in the 10th century, so he's a long time ago, but he basically says that there has to be a line at which Torah still makes sense. Judaism believes in a system of mitzvahs. Mitzvahs require certain actions, okay? If when it says, you shall have no, he gives an example, you shall have no unleavened bread in your home for 7 days on Pesach, if you take that figuratively, then you might say, well, maybe that means that I shall have no sin in my house, or something like that. And the answer is, well, then you've just kind of jettisoned one of the mitzvahs of the Torah, which is to get rid of chametz. So how did you just do that? And he goes through various different examples of where if you take something non-literally, you've undermined either a mitzvah or a core hashkafic principle which we derive as being part of Judaism, like the existence of miracles. If you turn around and say, well, this miracle didn't really happen, it's just figurative for something else, then what have you achieved by that? You've undermined some fundamental principle. And the question really is, and in this I kind of agree a little bit, with what Sarah was saying, as to, well, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Like, you first have your principles, and then you work out that you cannot say something's not literal because it undermines those principles. On the other hand, you're learning principles from the text, as it were, itself. So I'm still trying to work out exactly how this works. But there is no question that Rav Saadia Gaon seems to be laying down a fairly key guideline. And I'm not aware, and that doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but I'm not aware of anyone else who really lays down any other kind of guideline, which is that the psukim, just to summarize, have to be taken literally, other than these four situations, which are either that our senses tell us that this is obviously not right, our rationale, based on the understandings of the hashkafas of Judaism, God is unlimited, etc., tell us that this cannot be what it means. The rabbis themselves explicitly tell us that it cannot be, it's not literal, like in Job, etc. Or that there's another posuk somewhere else which tells us clearly, clarifies and says that this posuk wasn't meant to be taken literally. Everywhere else, says Rav Saadia Gaon, you are obliged to take the psukim literally. There are areas which clearly seem to be questionable. The whole creation story. How literal are we meant to take that creation story? How literally are we meant to take this idea of two naked people and a talking snake? Is the snake a snake? Are Adam and Chava just to people wandering around a garden with lots of trees? Or does it really convey something which is much, 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 much deeper and it has an entirely non-literal level? That's a good question as to how that works. How literally are we meant to take different areas of the psukim in the narrative? When it says Noah had an ark and he put everybody on the ark, is that meant to be literally everyone got on the ark and it was a miracle and it's incredible, but that's how it happened? Or is it meant to be somehow representative of something else? You'll have to try and fit these questions into Rav Sajigon and try and work out whether his test for what is and what isn't literal is met in different situations. This is not an easy subject, but I just wanted to try and give you a little bit of guidance as to how it's dealt with. It's much more tempting today, of course, to say, well, everything's literal. But of course, if you say that, that doesn't stand any kind of scrutiny at all because of all the things that clearly cannot be literal. But people obviously feel nervous going into this area because it is the agenda of other groups within the Jewish world to take things less literally. I hope that was of some help, some use, gives you some sources to look at. It's a sort of Thursday afternoon, quite late, but Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll maybe think about these another time. Okay, have a lovely Shabbos, and I'll see you on whenever, next week.
What did you parallel
when Paro kidnapped Sarah last week?